ready to hear argument in 030794, Sean Tree versus Jimmy Trang and Milky Way Trang.
May I please support Mr. Grant Hawkins to present argument for the petitioner? The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. Let me start by looking at what the lower court has done in this case, and specifically look at some of their language. And if you go back to their opinion, they acknowledge what has been the law in this state, that parties, and I'm quoting from the lower court, parties cannot engage in a conspiracy to be negligent. And that's following the long line of cases from this court, which say the same thing. But here's where they fall off the wagon. They go on to say, in the very same paragraph, quote, this rule does not entail that parties cannot conspire to cause injury by their negligence. It's kind of a tongue twister. For a guy like me, it took a while to read it, try to understand what they're saying. They're really just trying to get around what they just said in the preceding sentence. And it's interesting, they don't cite in that opinion, in that statement, which is really the paramount of their opinion, they don't cite a case to support that position that parties cannot conspire to cause injury by their negligence. So anyway, what they've done is, they go on to say, still quoting from that same opinion, in this case, the case we're about here today, it was a conspiracy not to prevent. And I guess what they're saying, a conspiracy not to prevent negligence. Well, what they did, mind you, the court issued one opinion and withdrew it. And in their second opinion, they found the Reed case. And the Reed Tool case, is out of this court, which directly disavowed this very position. In the Reed case, they tried to get around the workers' comp statute that said an employer is not can't be sued for negligence. And so in Reed, they argued, and it was a first court of appeals case, they argued that you could set up or perhaps conspire or create an environment that allows for a negligent accident. And you can do that by intentional conduct. Well, so this court, this lower court, the first court, said, okay, we're going to take Reed, it appears, and we're going to apply it to these set of facts, but they applied it to the wrong way. What they should have said is that even if we look at Reed, even though the other side didn't argue this, even if we were to look at Reed as an application to this set of facts, this court, the Supreme Court, has already decided you can't do that. You can't conspire. You can't create a cause of action by saying that the parties, in effect, intentionally set up a situation that allowed for negligent conduct. So what they've done is they've taken the Reed case. They cite the Reed case as their only authority, but the Reed case directly is opposite of their position in this case. Because Reed does not say that. Reed says you cannot have a claim or a basis for your claim by saying that there was an intentional conduct of the parties that set up this, quote, negligent event in the Reed case at the workplace. And in this case, our case here today is a premise case. So the same application applies. And so if you were to follow the court's reasoning, it would throw out 5 Supreme Court cases that have said that you cannot conspire to be negligent.
Can you have a conspiracy to further the criminal acts of sexual assault on plaintiffs? Could there be no conspiracy to further other persons' criminal acts?
There might be, Your Honor, if there was an underlying participation in that tort, meaning that if, for instance, in this case, my clients, if they participated in the underlying tort, it had a finding against them of something intentional, whether it be a criminal statute violation, whether it be intentional infliction of emotional distress, whether it be perhaps gross negligence. But there was no finding in this case by the jury that the petitioners participated in any underlying tort in the furtherance of a criminal act or in the furtherance of an intentional tort, which is what this court has said all along that is required. And that's what the pattern jury charge says. In this instance, the jury only found that the petitioners were negligent. ordinary negligence and assigned 5%, 5%, 10% collectively. And so the short answer to the question is no, because there was no finding of participation in the underlying intentional tort. There was only a finding of simple and ordinary negligence. And so what the court is essentially done below is created, in effect, a perhaps a claim on the basis of simple conspiracy.
It's difficult for me to understand how sexual assault can be negligence. Can you explain the underlying tort theory, how that can be?
Well, it can't be. You're right. And so, but they did not, in the trial court, there was no submission of a question against the petitioners on a participation in the assault, on a participation in any intentional conduct, whether it be intentional infliction of emotional distress.
But it was negligence per se.
Against the perpetrator.
I understand.
Not against my client.
I understand.
Okay.
But tell me how you can have negligence against the perpetrator. Why is that not an intentional act?
Well, what was stipulated at trial is that the perpetrator assaulted and was sent to prison in California for that. And that's a violation of the assault statute, even here in Texas.
So I take it that's not in the record.
That's not in the record, no. And so it was just a negligence per se of a criminal statute that was stipulated against the person that did it. It was undisputed.
I understand that. I'm just talking about in theory. In reality, it's hard for me. I mean, negligence per se doesn't seem to fit this analogy for me. Negligence per se, at least the context I've seen it in, has been in traffic statutes. You violate a traffic statute and they call that negligence per se. It seems to me a penal statute that requires some level of intent, it's hard for me to see how violating a penal statute just can conceptually be negligence per se. Are there cases that acknowledge that that is a viable underlying theory, or are we just stuck with a weird stipulation here?
I think we're stuck with a weird stipulation that was, in the basis, my recollection without the record, was that because he violated a state statute, whether it be a criminal or whatever, it was a violation of a state statute. And so it was just stipulated that there was a negligence per se.
I understand what happened. But, I mean, are there any cases that recognize negligence per se based on a criminal statute?
I haven't seen it. And so that was just a stipulation between them. Then the negligence that was found against the petitioners, my clients, was just was conditioned on the premises. And it was just a straight premise liability question of negligence. In fact, the instructions themselves speak to that issue against Theravada Buddhist Corporation, which was the owner of the premises. So the negligence per se in that particular issue really was isolated with respect to the perpetrator.
So you wouldn't have any problem with the conspiracy finding if, in fact, the underlying intention had been a criminal act?
If there had been...
In other words, an intentional act.
An intentional act, you're right.
So they may have stipulated themselves out of the conspiracy piece, is your argument?
They may have, by that simple stipulation and by the fact there wasn't a finding against the petitioners of any intentional act or any intentional conduct. In fact, the jury specifically rejected malice and gross negligence, which elements have specific intent in it. And so there was... The whole conspiracy theme requires this participation. I mean, unless you go along with the lower court as it stands right now, there has to be, it's a derivative tort. There's got to be something that the conspiracy ponies up to and rides along with in order for the conspiracy to be applied to whoever is found in violation of some specific intent court finding, and that's not what occurred here. And so that the trial court properly did not apply or did not incorporate that finding into the judgment, because it was in a sense a no finding. And what would happen if the court were to undo the Reed case and the other four cases that have been issued by this court in the last 20 years on this very issue? here's what would be created. You would go back and allow a situation like they argued in Reed. You could conspire to create a negligent workplace. You could conspire to create negligent premises. You could conspire to create a negligent intersection. You could conspire to create negligent manufacturing. You could conspire to create negligent services. You could conspire to create a negligent sale of goods. And that's really what they're saying here, is that it's creating a whole body or a whole issue of litigation that has never been created by this court. And we would argue that the court would be consistent and would be following what it has laid down pretty specifically in prior years with respect to this type of case and these types of facts and these types of findings.
Two questions. Can you summarize your objection to the submission of conspiracy in questions 7 and 8 during the court's charge? And second, can you tell us how you preserve the error in a notice of appeal?
Question 7 and 8 being
the conspiracy question. The conspiracy. What were your objections to the court charge?
Probably at the time, without the record on that, but at the time it would have been that there's no evidence, and that...
Why is there not the record on that?
Because it wasn't brought up as part of the appeal.
That's part of my question. Would it be your responsibility to complain of a judgment that the court erred in submitting the charge as it was, or that the judgment was incorrect, and then provide the court of appeals with the record from which to review that challenge?
We didn't challenge the judgment. We had no problem with the court judgment that was entered, so there was nothing that we found was error with respect to the judgment as was entered, because we believe the court properly applied the law to the findings that were found. And since there was no finding of a participation in an underlying tort, in a specific intent tort, as required by this court, the court properly did not incorporate the conspiracy finding in our judgment. And also, so there was no reason for us to pursue that angle, because the court properly applied this court's law, presumably, to that finding, because it was almost a naked finding or a finding of no consequence, because it was not conditioned or did not have an underlying tort to go along with it, the underlying intentional tort that I spoke about earlier. And then, with respect to the other issue, what the court, let me remind you that the judgment ultimately was against Theravada Buddhist Corporation, not against Reverend Tree. Reverend Tree is a petitioner here in this case, because the Court of Appeals reversed that part of the judgment also and put personal liability on him, even though the trial court, before, and it's incorporated in the judgment, that is in the record, the trial court, before the jury ever got the charge, found as a matter of law that Reverend Tree was acting in the course and scope of his employment for Theravada Buddhist Corporation. And so what we've argued and what we've said is that now, without a finding at trial of any piercing of the corporate veil by the litigants, the Court of Appeal has gone back and said, no, he needs to be individually responsible for this negligent conduct of the corporation. And if you go back and look at the questions that were submitted to the jury, they were premise liability questions, and they speak specifically about Theravada Buddhist Corporation failed to exercise care to protect, failed to adequately warn, and failed to make a condition reasonably safe. All premise liability questions, all conditioned and instructed to the jury about Theravada Buddhist Corporation. The point is, and as this court has said in the past, is that there was no independent duty.
But we don't know that, because we don't have a record.
Well, that we do have the record about what the court said in the judgment. If you look at the judgment, the court found as a matter of law that Chan Tree was acting within the course and scope of his employment with Theravada Buddhist Corporation. She did incorporate that in the judgment. That is a record in front of you. And there was no finding anywhere in the jury, and we do have the jury charge, there was no finding of any independent tort or negligent conduct on behalf of Reverend Tree.
Well, and that could have been negligence. I mean, there could have been evidence, we just don't know, that he knew that there had been sexual assaults many times before and did nothing to prevent it, and that could have been in the course and scope, and he could have been liable for that independently of premises liability. We just don't know.
We do know because of the I see my time is up. Can I proceed? We do know because of the jury charge itself and the judgment. We have the judgment that says he acted in the course and scope. We have the jury charge that has specific instructions as to who had the duty for the care and watch of the premises, and that was Theravada Buddhist Corporation. There was no finding of a separate relationship. There was no finding of him acting outside of the course and scope, because that would be in direct conflict with the record you do have, which is that the court said, as a matter of law, he is in the course and scope of his employment with Theravada Buddhist Corporation.
Thank you, counsel. I neglected to mention that Justice Brister is not sitting in this case. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Kevin McEvely, present argument for the respondent.
Honorable Justices, may it please the court. I'd like to begin first with a focus on two points. One is, with response to your question, Chief Justice Jefferson, and yours, Justice O'Neill, this case was predicated upon the felony conviction of Dong Quat for the rape of the two plaintiffs. And when Chief Justice Jefferson poses the question, can you have a conspiracy to further a sexual assault? The petitioner is forced to acknowledge, well, of course you can. And then Justice O'Neill asks, well, how does that get to be mere negligence? That really is an intentional tort that seems to be apart from negligence. And Justice O'Neill, I believe the answer to that is the anomaly is created by the fact that alternate theories were pled against the defendants other than Dong Quat. Dong Quat was the perpetrator of the rape. At trial, he did not appear, did not contest the allegations against him. Nevertheless, his conviction was proved. It was acknowledged. The petitioners themselves, in their brief before the Court of Appeals, referred to him as a convicted felon, convicted and serving time for sexual assault. So whether that's the answer to the question, is that in the record? It most certainly, definitely is.
What is?
The fact that Dong Quat was a rapist convicted of several sexual assaults.
And I understand, is it your contention that then, because he's a convicted felon, we should just presume it was an intentional act that supports the conspiracy?
Well, I don't think it takes a presumption, Justice O'Neill. I think the answer to it is the judge, this wasn't really a stipulation, the judge directed a verdict on that. And the anomalous situation is that one of the things that was going to be required of the court, if only negligence were found against the other defendants, was to divide up their proportional responsibility in accordance with the statute. So there had to be a question submitted to them that inquired of the conduct of Dong Quat. The way the court worked that was that she asked whether or not all the parties were negligent, and she instructed that Dong Quat's negligence was a proximate cause so that he would be included in the proportional responsibility statute.
I was trying to get at what this judgment meant, and based on the transcript of the post-verdict motions, it seems to what the judge was telling you was, yes, you got a finding on conspiracy, but you never tied it to any damages from the conspiracy. The only damages she had before her were jury findings on negligent damages, and she said, I can't translate that to conspiracy damages.
Actually, the findings, Justice Owen, I think that was one of the things that was troubling the trial judge, but the findings were tied to the damages that were caused by Dong Quat, which she directed.
Well, this is my question. We don't have a record. We don't have the trial transcript. And in your, I'm not sure whose arguments, but the trial judge, a lot of the evidence cited for conspiracy was things that happened after the sexual assaults. For example, in the arguments to the trial court, you said, well, look at the evidence of the conspiracy. These people came in and accused the women of lying. They showed up at preliminary hearings and made fun of her, made fun of them and were disparaging of her. After the sexual assault, they spirited the perpetrator out of the country. So a lot of the evidence that you were telling the trial court went to the conspiracy issues had nothing to do with the sexual assault itself. So it seemed to me the trial court was saying you don't have damages that correspond to your finding of conspiracy.
Well, in discussing whether or not there was evidence, of course, Your Honor, what we were dealing with was whether or not the court would disregard the issue, which he could only do if it shouldn't have been submitted in the first place or if there were no evidence of it. The court specifically did not disregard
it. That's what I was trying to figure out. What had she had done? It seems to what she was telling you at the post-judgment, post-verdict hearing was, I'm not going to disregard the conspiracy finding, but you, she said, I think directly, I gave you the issue you asked for, and you didn't ask for damages. And so she said, I'm not going to unfind the conspiracy finding, but since there are no damages to go with it, I'm not going to give you anything on this conspiracy finding.
Well, Justice Owens, I don't believe that's what she said, because remember, the conspiracy finding was the conspiracy question was predicated upon the finding of damages in the our earlier question where she directed a verdict against Nguyen Quan. So I don't think that was what's troubling her, I think it's probably impossible to say from the words that were spoken. I think what we do need to say is from what happened in the case.
But we don't have a record of what happened in the case.
Well, we do have a record, and the record is an abbreviated record because the fact that they were co-conspirators was something that was a fact that was found by the jury and not objected to. And I think this goes to Chief Justice Jefferson to the question.
But there has to be predicate intent someplace.
And it,
right?
It,
I mean, you agree with that.
Absolutely agree with that, Justice Hackett.
So where all we have is a negligence finding. So where do we look to find it?
No, I think we look in the charge. And the charge that we got in the case on conspiracy came directly from the Texas pattern jury charges. And that requires that for you to find that a party was a part of a conspiracy, we ask that question the same way, you have to find that they had knowledge of, agreed to, or intended the common objective or course of action that resulted in damages to the plaintiff.
But the pattern jury charge says you have to have as a predicate a finding of an intentional tort or an unlawful act.
I don't think you have to have a finding of
that,
Your Honor.
That's what the pattern jury charge says.
Well, the pattern jury charge says condition on the findings of a tort or statutory violation that proximately caused the damages. And the judge did say that there was a statutory violation. That's why she called it negligence per se.
She didn't say negligence per se. She just said, I instruct you that what was negligence. That's all she told the jury.
I think Your Honor is right about that. That's all she did say. But as Justice O'Neill says, there wasn't any question about that. What Nguyen Quan did was he raped these girls. If she called it negligence in order to allow the proportional responsibility to be worked out, I don't know if that's an error that you can hold against the plaintiffs. But it was clear that was the damage that was alleged, and that was the only damage that was found.
But that's where I have the problem. We don't have a record, and the argument to the judge was, look at all these damages, mental anguish damages that these women were put through because of this conspiracy that occurred after the sexual assault. And so I'm having a hard time with no record, and the arguments that were made to the court post judgment. She's from what I read, is saying you don't have any damages go with this.
I think that's answered by the law of conspiracy. It doesn't make any difference when these damages occurred, Your Honor. Because they were damages that were occasioned by the work of a co-conspirator, all the members of the conspiracy are responsible for them.
But the damages found by the jury were for premises liability and negligence,
not
conspiracy.
Premises liability and negligence, but they were all tied to this same act. It was the only there wasn't anything else that happened other than that they were raped by Nguyen Quan. There wasn't anything, and nobody alleged, and there wasn't any proof that they fell or had anything else happen to them. They were raped by one of the books.
The conspiracy, all I have is the transcript of the hearing, and somebody was arguing, well, all these post assault things that were so bad that were part of the conspiracy had nothing to do with the jury's finding of premises liability or negligence in the sexual act itself. And so that's where I'm having the disconnect.
Well, I think it's all bound up in the law of conspiracy that each one of these co-conspirators is responsible for every act of the other conspirators. And the acts of the conspirator, particularly most effectively, the act of Dunn Quap was what caused the damages to these women. I don't think that was really a question that was in dispute. Certainly nobody disputed that they had been raped. Dunn Quap wasn't in a position to. He wasn't there, and his conviction was absolutely proved. And that underlies everything about this case, the fact that these people were victims of a sexual assault. And I don't think that we need a finding to say, well, was the sexual assault an intentional act? I think we know that innately. And I don't think there was any question about it, and there wasn't any question about it in the Court of Appeals.
Well, that gets back to my question. Do we have to find that? Do we have to say, although it was termed negligence per se, it really is in the nature of intentional tort, and therefore it will support the conspiracy theory in order to rule your way?
I'm not sure if I understand whether that was framed in the negative or the positive, but I think all we have to do to rule my way is rule as I urge the court to rule, that the finding of a conspiracy in connection with an intentional act, and there's no question that there's an intentional act.
And the intentional act here is negligence per se.
The intentional, and the way that question is framed on this paper that we got when we came in here, yes, I think that does, by definition, that constitutes negligence per se. Any violation of a statute constitutes just by definition negligence per se.
But even
I don't mean to say, Your Honor, that...
Even negligence per se wasn't in the jury charge. It was just negligence. They were simply instructed that Quat was negligent. There wasn't even negligence per se in the jury charge. So we're asking us to go from common law negligence to an intentional tort, it seems to me.
Well, I think it wasn't in the jury charge, Your Honor, because it wasn't an issue in dispute. What Dunn Quat did was something that was acknowledged by everybody at all times. It just wasn't in dispute.
But you're arguing sort of a continuum. I mean, whether it's put in the charge as negligence or negligence per se, it was stipulated to be negligence per se, and you're saying on the continuum of negligence and intentional act, negligence per se we must deem to be on the intentional side.
I'm not going to go as far as that, Your Honor, and that's what I was getting to. I don't know that everything that would be considered negligence per se, and I heard Your Honor say that, my goodness, a traffic speeding could be negligence per se. I'm not willing to go as far as that, but certainly a felony rape can be the intentional act that underlies the finding of a conspiracy.
Yeah, help me here. What if the trial court had not submitted this as negligence?
Well, I think Your Honor is helping me, because I was going to say that. I don't think she needed to submit, given the fact that the issue about whether or not Dunn Quat was had committed these crimes, I don't believe they had to submit anything. If in other words, if we weren't trying to hold these defendants responsible for negligence or conspiracy, if we had just asked them, do you find that these people were involved in conspiracy with Dunn Quat, I think that certainly would be enough.
But you've got to have intent to be part of the conspiracy.
And I think
can't be negligent.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
So somebody says, you know, you better be careful about that friend of yours. He might commit rape, and I don't ever ask him, and I don't ever talk to him, and I don't ever do anything. I'm not part of a conspiracy.
Right.
And he goes and rapes somebody. I'm not part of a conspiracy.
Absolutely right.
But if somebody says he might commit rape, and I say, are you going to commit rape? And he says, yeah, maybe over there. And I say, well, here's the key. Then I'm part of a conspiracy.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor.
So where do we have that finding about, like, Tree and the other?
If they had not found intent, they could not answer the conspiracy question, yes. The conspiracy question required knowledge of, agreement to, and intention, which is approved in the pattern jury charges and amounts to all the elements of conspiracy under the Massey case, which sets the elements of conspiracy out. So I don't think
that... If she had submitted damages... They are negligent damages. I mean, they're based on premises liability and common law. Where are the conspiracy damages that match up with the conspiracy?
There's no difference, Your Honor. They were the same damages.
I keep coming back to that. You say there's no difference, but that's not what you were telling the trial court. When you argued post-judgment for your mental anguish damages and all this other, you were talking about post sexual assault actions by the these defendants?
Well, I don't really remember the argument.
Somebody
around,
was.
But,
so
but, I'd be surprised if anybody from the plaintiff's side argued that the damages were any different for the conspiracy, because the conspiracy damages encompassed all the damages that were done to these girls. They couldn't be divided out. That's really...
The premises liability issue, well, the record is what it is, I guess.
Would your argument have been easier if there were a question submitted that says, did the parties named below engage in a conspiracy to sexually assault the plaintiffs? Or, you know, if it were framed in not in negligence terms, but in the sort of intentional tort term, the conspiracy, that's the way we usually see conspiracy.
Well, I think it would have been different. The reason that we see it this way is because we submitted it exactly the way the pattern jury charge said, was the defendant a part of conspiracy to damage the plaintiff. So we submitted it in an effort to avoid difficulty at any time after trial. We submitted it in the way that was instructed for us. I want to get to the question, and I think we may have covered it, that it was framed on that paper when I got here, a question about whether or not the Court of Appeals opinion raises the issue of whether or not conspiracy is a standalone tort. And I'd like to answer that head on, but I think that it depends on what you mean by standalone tort. Certainly, if standalone tort means, or by whoever uses that term, standalone tort, if they mean, well, they can have a conspiracy and there doesn't need to be any underlying unlawful conduct and intentional act, no, if they just confide that, then it can't be a standalone tort. But if the question means, do you have to find that the co-conspirators themselves, in this case the petitioners, were themselves guilty of another tort, well, the answer is clearly that they don't have to, that they can stand alone from that. The co-conspirators don't have to be guilty of any tort other than negligence.
Let me ask you just this question, since we have a limited record. Just assume with me that all the court had was the charge with the findings on negligence and apportioned responsibility. How could a court say there is a finding of an underlying intentional act that is separate in part from negligence? See what I'm saying? I think we all agree the Texas law doesn't recognize a conspiracy to be negligent. Justice Eck mentioned there's got to be some form of intent involved. And the only time intent is mentioned is in question 7 and 8 of conspiracy, but it doesn't tell us what the underlying act is. So if we had only this court's charge, how could we form an opinion that says this judgment stands?
Well, I think that gets back to the question that Your Honor posed to Mr. Harpold, which was, well, what was your objection to that charge? And the answer is that that I don't believe they objected on the basis that the court suggests, and they did not carry forward into the Court of Appeals any complaint that there was anything wrong with the charge or actually anything wrong with the finding. But the answer to your question, Your Honor, I think is, how would you find out? The allegations against Don Quat were absolutely taken as confessed. And so that's where you would find the intentional conduct, in that he was accused of rape and he essentially confessed to it. Everybody conceded it at trial. It wasn't an issue that was in dispute. Just wasn't in dispute. And as my counsel would remind the court, if he were up here, it was contained within the briefs. Nobody disputed it in the briefs.
But
both briefs.
You say it was conditioned. And so I kind of hear you arguing from both sides, because you say, well, it was conditioned on an answer to question 3, which was damages. And in the damages question, had to do with was following the negligence and the quote occurrence in question, which was the negligence. So it seems like it was all tied to negligence, not an intentional act.
Well, it was tied to damages, Your Honor, because I think you have to tie it to damages. If there weren't any damages, it wouldn't make any difference. If there were a conspiracy, there was a finding of damages. And because there was a conspiracy, the damages were the same. Every act of the co-conspirators is chargeable against each of them.
It uses the occurrence in question, which is the same language throughout.
Which was the rape.
And the, but the findings of the jury were not right. The findings of the jury were premises liability and negligence.
And Your Honor, I don't want to quarrel with the court about it. That those were the findings of the jury to the disputed facts. The rape wasn't a disputed fact.
But the
you're relying on footnote 2 of the Court of Appeals opinion.
Well, I saw footnote 2 of the Court of Appeals, Your Honor, and I think that footnote 2 is the one that that Mr. Harpold wants to talk about. I don't think footnote 2 goes far enough. I think the court is right to say, look, this finding of conspiracy doesn't say that the conspirators were guilty of negligence or negligence per se. It means that they were that they were conspirators and that they intended the harm that resulted to this plaintiff. I think the way footnote 2 worded is a little peculiar, but I think that's all they're saying there, that the particular conspirators, these petitioners particularly, don't need to be guilty of negligence or negligence per se to be conspirators. They just had to be conspirators with a person that was responsible for the illegal act.
Thank you, counsel. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Just briefly.
Let me ask you, if all I know, and we have trouble in this case because we have to put on blinders and just look at the charge. If all I know is that the definition in question 7 is true, as found by the jury, then why isn't that enough to establish the intentional conduct required for conspiracy?
Because conspiracy is a derivative tort. It has to be conditioned, as Justice Owen pointed out, on an underlying finding or some other finding of tort conduct, which what they're arguing in the question, I think I've understood it, is taking conspiracy in a standalone situation.
Well, no, I'm asking a different question. Rape is a tort.
Right.
Okay, so we've got an actor, and he committed a tort, and the question is, did anybody else intentionally join with him in doing that? Isn't that right?
Right.
And then, so the definition in question 7 says, you can't answer this question unless you find knowledge or agreed to or intended, a common objective, which was the rape. And certainly if somebody intended to help somebody else rape somebody, that would be a conspiracy. Don't you agree? So then why don't we have that finding?
Because the only thing I can say in response to that is that is a finding in and of itself, by itself. It's not conditioned or it's not derivative of the underlying tort, the participating tort, the tort that the conspiracy feeds off of, if lack of a better word. Meaning that you can have that finding. I think this is what the trial court did. Yeah, you had that finding, but you didn't have it. It wasn't conditioned, as the pattern jury charge says, on any other underlying tort, perhaps other than negligence, as Justice Owen said. And so it can't on its own be a finding that stands up because it's not derivative of some other finding against these petitioners, and that's what happened here.
Do you take it on the record that is before us that the conduct by Cott, the perpetrator, is established or not?
What he did?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. But the problem is, from this record, we don't know whether these defendants were accused of not paying enough attention, and that's all the evidence was, or if they gave Cop the key that said, here, go and do what we know what you're going to do. Go ahead and do it. And all we have is this finding.
Well, I think this charge gets us here. Gets us there. And I think this charge supports the judgment that the trial court entered. And here's why. Because within this charge, the jury was asked a question about specific intent and malice, or perhaps something that somebody might be able to argue that bolsters or that is derivative with the conspiracy, and that was the question about malice and gross negligence, and the jury rejected it, said no. And we can also impliedly read from the jury charge that since there was not a question of intentional infliction of emotional distress, there wasn't perhaps a question of civil assault, or not in this case, but another analogy would be fraud, a conspiracy to defraud somebody. You'd have to find people involved in the underlying tort of fraud in order to...
I think they're saying there is. I think they're saying that the finding against the perpetrator here, although termed negligence, it clearly was stipulated to be an intentional act. I mean, it was stipulated to be a violation of the penal statute. Why would that be different from an underlying finding of fraud?
But there's no finding that the petitioners were participated in that. And that
well, but think of it in a different way. Say the first question was, did this defendant, rape the plaintiffs? And then the next question, conditioned on an affirmative answer to that, says, did these defendants conspire with the rapist to harm the plaintiffs? If you have those two together, the key example that Justice Heck gave, would that be enough for there to be a conspiracy that would cause all the perpetrators to or co-conspirators to share in the damages?
If it identified the tort that they participated in, then perhaps. This question, either within
and you don't submit questions where there's no dispute in the evidence. So there's no question that the defendant, the perpetrator here, committed the sexual assault. That's undisputed. So you don't have to submit that. It would be the court, it would be wrong to submit a question that everyone agrees on. So you don't submit that, and you submit the conspiracy. And in the conspiracy, you have this element of intent. Why is that not enough?
Well, in this case, it wasn't done that way. But if the conspiracy question was set up with the specific guidelines, and with it being conditioned back to that derivative tort, or to that underlying tort, or participation in the underlying tort, then you would be right. But this question, in this case, was not set up that way. This question was not asked that way. The only connection or condition that this question was tied to was a question of negligence and negligence damages and premise liability, which was in the trial court, I think, properly applied the law to the finding that she had based on the jury charge in front of her. She did that with respect to the conspiracy question.
Thank you.
And she did that on the individual question.
Thank you, Patrick. Any further questions? The cause was submitted then, and the court will take another brief.